There's a really nice urban trail not too far from my house. Miles of old railroad routes converted into paved paths for skaters and cyclists and pedestrians. Families use them all the time. But it wasn't until literally last weekend that I saw something so unusual, I'm still thinking about it. A little boy on a bike, maybe 7 years old, eight, happily riding down the trail with no parent in sight. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It was broad daylight. It would be impossible for the kid to get lost. And this section of the trail connects parks and neighborhoods without the need to navigate car traffic. In short, it is as perfect as a place can be to give a kid a taste of independence. But because most of the world hasn't been designed with child safety in mind, most parents have committed themselves to constant supervision of their kids, and both childhood and parenthood have suffered for it. Stephanie H. Murray is a contributing writer at The Atlantic, which published her recent article, The Gravitational Pull of Supervising Kids All the Time. Stephanie, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So you have written previously about this experience your family had on a nice afternoon in June, which, like, depending on when and where people grew up, might sound completely normal or completely shocking. What happened on that day?
Yeah, so I took my kids to a little sort of neighborhood in Amsterdam called Funen Park. I believe that's how it's pronounced. And it was kind of strange, I think, especially as an American, because it was sort of, you know, a standard neighborhood in the sense that it was a bunch of apartments, but it was set up in a kind of interesting way where there were no private gardens. It was just sort of apartments set on sort of like plots of grass, open grass, with no cars, no parking garages or anything, no parking spot, no street parking, nothing like that. So it was just complete sort of open space that was shared and communal. And there was, you know, some, I can't remember exactly what kind of stores were there, but they did have some, you know, I believe like a place to get your hair cut and little things that were sort of sprinkled throughout there, things that people need, you know. But within that little area, you know, I left my kids, you know, with their dad at the playground that was also there. And I kind of wandered around on my bike. And there were just kids everywhere. There were young kids, old kids, you know, just kind of out and about, walking dogs, playing sort of like pickup games, you know, without parents supervising them. I remember, you know, sort of winding my way back to this playground and seeing this kid, you know, coming out as I was walking in. And he was, you know, a very small kid, maybe 6 years old, and he just hopped on his bike and sped off, right? Yeah, it was an interesting thing to see, definitely, as an American.
So kids were allowed to play there without, you know, an adult directly supervising them. You are young enough that you yourself grew up like hearing stories about the days when this kind of thing happened all the time, but you never experienced it yourself as a kid?
Yeah, certainly not in an urban setting, right? You know, I actually spent most of my childhood kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And so I had a little bit of that because it was just because I lived in rural America, but certainly not, you know, city living, like anywhere where there was actual cars around, you know, like people, a critical mass of people, you know, I've heard about sort of, you know, I feel like I hear, you know, my elders, I guess, talking about sort of nostalgic for the days of parenthood where you could just sort of like leave, you know, in the morning over summer. And then as long as you were back before the streetlights turned on, then you would, you know, that was the only rule, right? You know, and that's what it felt like I was witnessing, sort of, you know, this like hearkening back to the old days of childhood when you could really kind of just do what you wanted as long as you were home in time for dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Cool. As a Gen Xer, I grew up with maybe less freedom than my boomer parents had, but plenty more than I gave my kids who are Gen Z. And it turns out this reflects patterns in many parts of the world, right? There was this study conducted in Sheffield, England, about like the walking range of the average 8-year-old through the years. By 2007, That walking range had gone from a number of miles to most kids weren't allowed to go farther than the end of their block.
I think that one sort of traced over a generation of a particular family. And I think actually that even walking to the end of your block for an 8-year-old is a lot of freedom in some parts of the world. I do think that there's some variation, right? So I think that it's, you know, in the Netherlands, there's more emphasis on it, independence for kids. So it's not quite as extreme as it is in the US or even in the UK. But I think this is happening. This has happened everywhere, this sort of shrinking roaming range of childhood.
Did viewing that little taste of independence that those Dutch kids were getting, did that feel liberating to you as a parent, the idea of it, or did it feel transgressive?
To me, it felt very liberating. I was envious, for sure. But I don't know that, you know, I don't know, that might be just me. I think that it might make some people nervous, for sure.
I mean, it's evident from crime statistics that modern parents in the U.S. overestimate the risk of horrific crimes like child abduction, which is not to say they don't happen. But there are really serious hazards for kids these days that may not have existed to the same extent in the past. One thing that does threaten kids' safety if they're left unattended in a lot of urban areas is traffic.
Oh, yeah. I think it's undeniable that, you know, well, I think the shrinking of roaming ranges sort of happened at the same time as two coexisting trends. One was urbanization. So a lot of people in America were moving into cities for a lot of the last century, right? But then at the same time, those cities were getting taken over, sort of increasingly taken over by cars. And that, I mean, that presents real threats to kids. And, you know, I think there's some disagreement about this. Some people sort of point to declining, you know, motor vehicle accidents and say, hey, this isn't really a big concern. But then there are other researchers and advocates like Tim Gill who point out that, you know, he's not really convinced that we've actually made it safer for kids to be out and about near cars. It's just that parents have socially responded to the reality of the cars, right? They've learned through past generations that cars are dangerous. They do hit people, and we haven't really done a lot to make them safe for kids to sort of walk around independently. And so they've sort of socially responded, and they don't let their kids near the street. So I think that's undeniably a real issue that other countries, in my opinion, are doing quite a bit more to sort of counteract. And the Netherlands is sort of famous for that. They recognized back in the 70s that a lot of kids were getting hit by cars, and they have taken great pains to address that issue. And I think just to a decent extent, they're succeeding.
Yeah, it's not entirely illogical that we don't feel safe letting children out of our sight. At the same time, of course, we're also shaped by social pressure. How are parents' choices for their own kids affected by what other parents and other adults in general think is appropriate?
Yeah, this is, I think, a really underappreciated aspect of sort of, you know, helicopter parenting, if that's what you want to call it. I think that over time, you know, as children, as it's become rarer and rarer for children to kind of be out and about on their own at fairly young ages, you know, people just aren't, parent or not, people aren't used to seeing kids out and about. And I think that that's had an effect on, you know, and based on conversations I've had with researchers as well, that's had an effect on how we view children, just generally the average person. And so we have come to see them as sort of more vulnerable and needing care. It's hard for us to sort of imagine them doing the sorts of things that they might have done, you know, 100 years ago, right? Sort of like walking, you know, wherever they want, right? Or walking to school, those sorts of things. It's harder for us to imagine them doing that because fewer people have any memory of doing that themselves. And it's just become kind of unusual. So understandably, a lot of times when people see a child out and about on their own, they think that maybe something's wrong, right? Or, it doesn't quite compute, or it's an aberration from the norm, right? And so then they're not sure quite what to do about that. And I think that that now has become kind of this strange sort of social barrier to letting your kids out and about in and of itself.
Yeah, that experience that I mentioned in the introduction about seeing this little kid on the trail, he looked like he was doing fine. I had so many thoughts observing this as I was kind of moving on foot in the other direction. First, I thought, this is really strange. Is there a mom or a dad or a babysitter, a quarter mile behind that I don't see yet? That was not the case. And then I wanted to make sure he was okay, and he seemed to be doing fine. And then I thought, gosh, if this had happened when I was a kid, it would not have been so strange at all. There might have been like herds of kids moving en masse along this trail because it's really a great space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so. Yeah, the average person is just sort of a little bit less used to it. There were one thing that a woman that I spoke to, she shared her experiences. She was the one, she told me that she finds herself worrying more about what other people are gonna think or do in response to seeing her child out and about alone than she does about their actual safety. And one thing she said is that she senses that even sort of older people who she sort of assumes would have had a lot more independence than the typical American kid does now. Even they seem to have adopted kind of the norm and expectation that kids are really closely supervised all the time. So she sort of, I think she said to me, it seems like they're holding me to a higher standard than even their parents were held to, or they fulfilled as parents themselves,
I mean, there's nothing more precious to most human beings than their children. So it's easy to tell ourselves better safe than sorry, but we're not just giving kids the added benefit of safety when we insist on supervising them at all times. We're also maybe depriving them of something, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that this is pretty important to understand. I spoke to a child developmental psychologist, and she said that, yes, everybody wants to keep their kids safe, and it is important to keep your child safe because, in order for them to survive, right? But independence sort of serves an important purpose in their proper development. And, so she said, so for example, things like separation anxiety, right? That's an ordinary fear that emerges during childhood, and serves an evolutionary purpose in keeping kids safe, right? But it doesn't go away on its own. It needs to kind of dis it needs to be sort of allayed, almost like stamped out through experiences that draw the child away a little bit further and further away from their parents and help them understand, like, oh, I'm okay. I'm not, the world doesn't end when my mom isn't near me, right? So it's pretty important for them to get a little bit of distance from a direct supervisor in order to sort of overcome natural anxieties and fears about the unknown, right? And then also, when parents aren't hovering, kids just kind of have to figure things out on their own, right? Which can sort of bolster their confidence and their resilience, and it sharpens their executive function, and it just kind of helps that it's necessary for them to be able to learn to function on their own confidently in the world.
So, Stephanie, kids have fewer opportunities these days to gain a sense of their own competence to function without adults looking after them. This is interesting, too. The less kids do for themselves and by themselves, the less we adults believe kids are capable of doing, full stop. This feels like a pretty destructive feedback loop over time.
Yeah, I think it is, and it's hard to I mean, it makes sense. It makes intuitive sense, that you don't see any kids out and about walking on their own, and so then you start thinking, well, maybe that's because they can't really do that, right? And so I think I would encourage everyone to sort of like think through, you know, their own assumptions. You know, it's easy to sort of point to helicopter parents, but I think that the average person may have internalized some ideas about children and the level of care that they need that is probably a bit more excessive than it would have been, you know, a century ago.
I think back to when my kids were in grade school. You know, in preschool, I made them stay away from sharp knives because you don't want a little kid necessarily using something that could really hurt them. Then they got into the middle grades, and I thought, am I going to wait till they're 17 before they're allowed to chop an onion to get ready for dinner? I mean, sometimes we have to like deliberately talk ourselves through the fact that our kids might be ready to try new things.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think that it's on an individual level, it's kind of scary. And I think that there isn't ever a time that it just sort of suddenly you wake up one day and it's not scary. So it's sort of like, I think it's a tricky thing as a parent to kind of think through, like, well, they're, you know, if they've never done something before, the first time they do it is always going to be a little nerve-wracking for me as a parent. And you kind of have to steel yourself against that.
In terms of kids being out on their own, I know where I live, I have friends who've had, 16-year-olds asked to leave, an arboretum space because they were unsupervised. You know, they were just kind of there to enjoy the place. That seems excessive. On the other hand, there's a lot wrapped up in whether parents feel safe about leaving their kids on their own in public. One is the culture of a place. Regarding how adults interact with children who are not their children, how does this work in a place like Paris?
Yeah, you know, so I can't tell you exactly how it works right now, but I interviewed a woman who she moved to Paris when she was 11 years old, I believe. And her parents, when she got there, they just let her kind of roam the city as she pleased, which was very common among her peers at the time. And when she was sort of reflecting on why that worked, why was that such a norm there? She thought it had at least something to do with the fact that Parisian adults just didn't really have any qualms in her experience of sort of like interacting with or even instructing a child that they didn't know, right? So she told me this funny story about how she was on a crowded bus in Paris one time and a seat opened up and she just hopped right into it, right? But then a gentleman that was standing there pretty much just sort of said, nope, you know, you got to get up and we're going to let this elderly woman sit down, right? She just thought she just thinks that Americans are, in her experience, are just a little more, they're uncertain about what kind of authority they have over a child that isn't their own, and maybe a little bit more hesitant to kind of instruct them. And you know, another researcher told me basically the same thing, that a lot of people these days, and particularly men, are very wary of interacting with a child that isn't their own, just because they're kind of assuming that, you know, that they might be sort of suspected of ill intentions. And you know, the way I put it in the piece is that parents don't trust strangers, and strangers know it, you know, and I think there's something to that, you know, like I don't know if the parent is going to get upset with me if I sort of like, you know, talk to this kid, so I'd better not.
Yeah, it's interesting, to think about that culture in Paris that your friend experienced. If it's permissible for adults to say, like, hey, that seat's for an elderly person, or hey, get down off there, you're going to break your arm. If that's generally accepted by parents, maybe the culture also develops a sense that you have kind of an obligation to step in. If you see a kid doing something dangerous or harmful to somebody else, you want to give them a gentle correction.
Yeah, and I think that that is sort of, I think that has to be part of the culture if you're going to, if we're gonna sort of try and return to a society where kids have more freedom, because the fact of the matter is that you know, even capable kids, you know, they're still learning, right? And so, you know, I think, you know, I spoke to Tim Gill, who's this advocate for children's play. He thinks that that kind of sort of rubbing shoulders with your with adults, sort of moving through society and making mistakes and being told, oh, you know, we don't do that here, or whatever it is. Having ordinary interactions with your fellow citizens is part of, you know, the process of growing up. It's a good part, right? And so there would have to be a bit of social buy-in, I think, for us to get back to a place where kids can move through society like that. There has to be some kind of system for interacting with people that aren't there, you know, haven't been, you know, put in charge of them specifically.
Instead, in the US, we've moved into this era of what we call intensive parenting. And we'll talk about the origins of that in a moment. But one thing it does is put all the onus on individual parents for their individual children's health and safety and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did it get started?
Well, yeah, so that's a pretty complicated question. So, you know, I think that I'll just talk through the big ideas. I think that economic inequality, which was sort of rising, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it kind of it made parents nervous about their they had less confidence in their children's, you know, future prospects. But, you know, every child wants their child, every parent wants their child to grow up and sort of have what they need, you know, in life. And I think it sort of undermined parents' confidence in their children's future prosperity. And so that kind of spurred this approach to parenting characterized by, you know, sort of curating experiences and education for your kids to get your kids ahead, right? So, you know, instead of just letting your kids sort of play freely, you know, in the time that they were out of school. Well, you want them in violin lessons, or you want them, you know, in some kind of extracurricular. And I think that had the effect of simply crowding out time for sort of like free play or wandering or that sort of thing. But I also think that, you know, if we're thinking a little bit more broadly about kind of what led to children not being out and about on their own, it wasn't just intensive parenting. It's also sort of like families changed, right? Women were joining the workforce, right? And so that meant that, you know, there was nobody at home, right, to sort of say, yeah, go out and play and then come back, you know, whenever you need a drink of water or whatever it is, right? So there were just fewer people at home. There were fewer families got smaller, right? So there were fewer older siblings to look after younger ones. So I think there was a little bit, there was a change in kind of the social cohesion on the home front, that led to just kids spending more time in these kind of structured educational environments, if that makes sense.
So we have this fear as parents that our kids will fall behind in the great rat race. We also have this fear of stranger danger. What effect has media coverage had on parents' perception of danger to their kids literally around every corner?
I mean, I think that just rising access to sort of this 24/7 news cycle, international, you know, news, you know what's going on in not just in your local area, but just sort of around the country and then other countries when something bad happens, right? You know, a lot of that can be quite negative, and you know, I think that the focus is probably a bit more on the negative than the positive. And so I think it just, the researchers I spoke to think that, I know there's been books written about this whole phenomenon of sort of stranger danger, and how it got blown out of proportion. But I think generally access to media, which is frequently fear-mongering, has just led to this maybe outsized perception of the threats that children face in public life.
So it's ironic that we feel the need to supervise kids in all sorts of situations, you know, just playing in their own front yard where we might not have done so in the past. It would seem as if this would cause every kid to feel safe and sort of buffeted from anything bad happening to them. Instead, we're in this moment where there's really a dramatic rise in the incidence of kids experiencing anxieties of all kinds.
Yeah, and I think it seems sort of on its face kind of counterintuitive, but it does make some sense if you sort of go back to the way that, how does anybody start to feel comfortable in the world? Well, they go out and they experience, independence, and it's terrifying at first, but then they realize, oh, I'm okay, I can handle it on my own. And so I think that, yeah, there's been sort of it's ironic is sort of the right word, I think. It's led to by not allowing kids to have that experience of realizing, hey, I can figure things out on my own. Not everybody's out to get me. The world can be a little bit scary, but I can manage, right? Then it's led to a place where a lot of kids maybe sort of feel persistently unsafe all the time because they've never had the experience to know otherwise. I think that is certainly one theory. There's that is, I would say, a growing chorus of psychologists and researchers are pointing to the lack of independence as a possible cause of this, rise in anxiety among young people.
What's really interesting, Stephanie, is I think this phenomenon flies in the face of our modern sense of our kids as truly exceptional, right? We think that they might be able to get a gymnastics scholarship, and we think they might be able to get a 1600 on the SAT if only we pour the right resources into them. But we no longer believe that they would know what to do if they took a spill on their bike, two blocks from our house and skin both knees. We worry that that's just too dangerous for them to handle.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It's sort of sometimes I'm sort of like, man, we're teaching kids the wrong skills. They don't like they can't, pack their own lunch or bike around to their friend's house, but they can, code or build a computer. I don't want to be, I'm not trying to be in any way judgmental because I do think we get sort of like mixed si signals. Part of the piece, I mean, a big point that I was trying to make is that even if you want, I believe that there are a lot of parents who recognize that they want their kids to have more independence. They want to let their kid, run an errand, walk to the store, walk to school, walk to the bus stop, or whatever it is, and not be constantly hovering. And they just feel this immense social pressure to kind of be there all the time. So it can be very tough, even if you want to do that. But yeah, I think we've kind of ended up in a really funny place where, kids have this exceptional education to do these really incredible things, but then on a basic level, just, can they get themselves from point A to point B? We're letting that one slide.
Yeah, alongside those evening news stories we hear about bad things happening to kids, which might magnify our sense of the risk of this, we also get these stories of parents being criminally prosecuted for allowing their kids to do things that were common a few decades ago, like playing alone in a park for a couple of hours. This can, in a lot of parts of the country, this can get a parent hauled into court.
Yes, that's a very important part. I think that, we've always had, so I guess I would say it's important to say it's not just sort of social pressure or peer pressure. It's also sort of, the looming threat of legal sanction that makes parents hesitate. And that's real. We have this infrastructure for safeguarding children against abuse and neglect. It's very important because a lot of children are, in fact, abused or neglected. But when people call to report neglect, which makes that makes up the majority of reports, what constitutes neglect, right? One civil rights attorney that I spoke to who wrote a book about this actually. Her impression is that over time, our collective understanding of what constitutes neglect has shifted to sort of reflect helicopter parenting norms. So, a lot of times, pretty frequently, people are being reported and potentially investigated, and yes, sometimes even, charged for letting children, maybe, even kids between, you know, 5 and 9, and sometimes even older, right, for allowing them to be sort of unsupervised for really any length of time. Just sort of the fact that they are on their own is what precipitates the call, right, the reporting, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of those cases are filtered out and people don't necessarily get punished for it. But, you know, to be investigated because, you know, you let your child, you know, walk to school or play outside of your apartment, I mean, nobody wants to get caught up in that. And so I think that the Diane Redleaf, she's the attorney that I was speaking to, she thinks that this has just had a chilling effect on parents' decisions, because, you know, if somebody sees your kid out and about and they think that 7 is too young for them to walk to the school bus stop, you know, there's nothing stopping them from calling, you know, the child abuse hotline. And people do. That is a thing that happens.
So, Stephanie, you note correctly, I think, that, you know, we have adjusted our laws to meet the norms of what we sometimes call helicopter parenting. Not to put too fine a point on this, helicopter parenting norms are, broadly speaking, white upper middle class parenting norms. That puts, you know, parents of color, lower income parents, at great risk if they don't meet those standards.
Yeah, you know, I think that this is increasingly pretty mainstream across class and race. That's the thing. I think intensive parenting, you know, what starts with sort of the white upper middle class makes its way through the rest of the population. So I think that if you're talking about who gets in trouble for sort of taking a more hands-off approach to parenting, you know, in terms of being reported, for example, to, you know, the child abuse hotline or being investigated, I think that lower income families, and in particular African American families in America, are much more likely to be caught up in that system. The last statistic I saw was that, you know, over 50% of Black kids will have some kind of contact with the CPS system in their childhood, right? So it's very common. And as for who's getting in trouble for sort of being a little more hands off, it's absolutely, you know, lower income families and Black families.
So as the parent of young children, do you and your friends talk about this a lot? Is everybody sort of frustrated but flummoxed as to how to push back on it?
I've been talking about it a bit more just because, you know, I've been thinking and writing and researching and reporting on it. And I do think that some of the conversations are a little bit funny. It's something that makes people nervous to talk about. Mm. I think that there's sort of a, I mean, this is just in my experience, but I think, and I did hear this from a couple of the parents that I spoke to, where, you know, sometimes maybe things, there's sort of what they're willing to do, like, oh, I'll let my kids, you know, play in the backyard, but, you know, I'm a little bit nervous to tell anybody that I do that, you know, because I'm just worried what they're going to think, right? And so sometimes with my conversations, it goes kind of like that, where I kind of test the waters, and I'm like, well, I want to give them independence, and then I sort of discover that they also want to give their kids independence, but, you know, they're just a little nervous to talk about it. So among my friends, a lot of them recognize the need for independence and find the pressure to sort of always be watching your kids a little bit suffocating. It's whether it's, you know, so between us, there's sort of an understanding, but then it's going beyond that that is the challenge, just sort of to strangers, people you don't know. It gets tricky, I think.
So for places that have tried to invest shared resources in, you know, making kids safer, alleviating some of that pressure on families, some of this can happen alongside, like, other kinds of urban planning. That's really what happened in Amsterdam, right? This wasn't an overnight set of changes. This was, if they have to tear up streets to, you know, put in new pipes or something, they're going to think about adding bike lanes or pedestrian lanes, things that might make things a little bit safer for kids.
Yeah, you know, cities, urban settings, you know, or suburban settings, right? They're constantly needing to be maintained, and sort of, you know, you have to tear up streets, as you said, you know, in order to just keep the city functioning, right? And so I think that a lot of the child-friendly urbanists, I guess, advocates would say just start incorporating children into those existing kind of things that are happening, right? Like, just start thinking about what is it like to be a child on this street, right? And sort of designing it accordingly, right? So you can kind of, I don't think that you need to tear down the city and then build a new child-friendly one in its place. But I think, incorporating kids into urban design as it is sort of moving, as it's happening all the time, is the way that we can make incremental change, And you're right, that's what happened in Amsterdam. They just started caring about it and looking for opportunities to make the city better for kids, and they are succeeding.
At the very least, I guess we need to align our policies with current expectations. It's occurred to me, at least where I live, like the public school system has pretty strict rules about who qualifies to ride a school bus. And some of that can, assume that a kid can walk 2 miles each way every day. That might have happened in the 70s. It's not happening today for the most part. And suddenly parents are left having to drive their kids to school every day. And that assumes they have a car. I mean, this all gets very complicated if we're not thinking in these ways.
Yes, absolutely. I think that car dependence and sort of that as a norm is it just sort of makes it kind of impractical, for yeah, that's an there's an interesting intersection. Like maybe now I think even I would say like 2 miles, that's kind of far for a kid to walk, So I think some emphasis on just sort of making sure that there are that schools, that institutions, that serve children are kind of close to where the children live is necessary for allowing them to sort of move independently between them. And, that's not something that is easily changed. There's got to be some sort of like coming together and understanding what the standard should be, because without that, then you're right, you're just sort of in a position where you have to drive your kids everywhere.
One of the sources you quoted, I think in the piece that you wrote about a year ago on this general theme, noted that most cities don't think about children as commuters, even though the vast majority of kids, 9 or 10 months a year, are making a two-way commute every day to school.
Yeah, that came up because one of the people that I spoke to lives in New York, and she just said, we do things in cities for adults that we don't do for kids, right? We have like rush hour, bus schedules because we know, oh, everybody's going to work, so we need to make sure that extra buses are going at this time. But they don't do that for children, even though children have a commute, a very common commute, which is going to and from school, right? And so they've kind of just I think a lot of this, start to finish, this whole issue of cities not really being hospitable to kids is that kids are kind of an afterthought. They're not actually thinking about them as sort of commuters, as people entitled to sort of like be able to move within the city. And they're, to a great extent, happy to just sort of like let parents kind of solve that problem, which parents are, and they are doing that by driving their kids to school or, walking them directly. They're signing them up for things rather than just letting them sort of find each other in the park because that's not an option. All of this is anywhere that we, on a public policy level or design level, decide not to sort of factor kids' needs into design. It's just sort of creating unnecessary burdens for parents.
Reading these pieces, Stephanie, it's really no wonder, even though these things don't seem to be directly related, that so many kids graduate from high school, move on to college somewhere, and are not quite as prepared to run their own lives as kids a generation or two ago.
Yeah, it makes intuitive sense to me, and I think there are a lot of people who think that these things are related, right? Like the less that we allow kids to do growing up, and I think it starts really early, right? Sort of the pressure to kind of do everything for your child and sort of and not really give your child agency, especially in public places, you know, that pressure emerges pretty early in a child's life, and it doesn't seem to dissipate. In America, it doesn't seem to dissipate until, you know, at least, you know, the tweens, maybe even teens. People just don't really seem culturally comfortable with kids kind of like moving through the world on their own or doing things on their own until that age. And I think that's pretty late, right? At least some researchers think it's too late. If you want kids to sort of like feel comfortable going off to college, right, which is what we, most of us want our kids to do, and know how to sort of organize their lives and feel comfortable doing that, then, you know, they need to be doing things on their own much, much earlier than that.
So you currently live in the UK, is that right?
Yes.
Are things very different there, or is it just like the US in terms of these pressures that parents feel and the sense that if you're not sort of keeping an eagle eye on your child, that child is in imminent danger?
So I think that it is somewhere in between, you know, Amsterdam and the US. I don't think it is as extreme as from, you know, and I'm just doing this based on sort of speaking to other, you know, parents in America, but then also looking at some of the surveys, you know, the idea that kids can't walk to school or be alone before or after school, which surveys say Americans are uncomfortable with pretty much until 12 or later. That's higher than it is here based on my impressions. I think that, you know, kids I'm pretty sure they allow kids to walk to school on their own here at 8. I don't know if that's throughout the UK, but in Bristol, that's what's allowed. And I see kids doing that all the time. So I don't think it's as extreme, but I wouldn't say, you know, when I go to the playground, most of the time parents are accompanying their kids. It's not like a Amsterdam situation where there's a 6-year-old just kind of like zooming off home for dinner.
So allowing kids a little bit of space to take some risks and gain some independence also requires us as parents to quell our own anxieties. Have you learned anything about how to do that, how to sort of quiet those voices in your head that say, it's probably fine, but what if?
Oh my goodness, that I don't know if I can help you with. I'm not sure. I think that one thing that was helpful for me, speaking to Mariana Brusoni, that psychologist, was just that the recognizing that, like, you know, it's scary. It's normal for it to be scary for you as a parent to sort of like see your child taking a risk. That's totally normal. But then so is the actual taking of the risk, right? So it's sort of like you don't have to focus, you know, you can think of risk as sort of more of a neutral thing, right? And just kind of focusing on what you think is going to be best for your kid, and then allowing for, you know, allowing something other than risk reduction to be your sort of goal, you know, once you kind of shift your thinking that way, I think it can be kind of liberating to think like, okay, risk reduction is not the end goal here. You know, raising a functioning child who is happy and capable of, you know, of living in the world on their own, that's the goal, right? And once you can kind of make that shift, I think it's easier to accept risk in your parenting, I guess.
It does also seem challenging in that kids today have seen so few examples of other children who have these freedoms that it may not occur to them to sort of push back on the kinds of constraints that modern parenting places around them.
I think there's some truth to that, right? It's in the water. I mean, nobody's unaffected by, you know, it's a norm. It's been established, right? And so from the perspective of the child as well, that's a really good point, that it's sort of like, okay, this is kind of unusual, you know? I kind of think it's one of those things where, you know, Dr. Brusoni said, you know, the best way to counteract that is power in numbers, right? So you want to kind of get a cup if you can, right? Try and find a couple of people to sort of like get on board. You know, if you can find a couple of other parents who are okay with a little bit of independence, then you can normalize it, not just for you, right, but also for your child. You know, I've started doing this a little bit. You know, I have a couple of friends in the area, and we do some sort of like babysitting swapping, right, you know, during the week, just to make our lives easier, right? And I have broached this idea of like, hey, if I allow my child to sort of walk to your house on their own, would you be okay with that? And they've been fairly receptive to that idea so far. And I think that if you can just get a couple of other people, right? If I'm saying it's okay and this other woman is saying that it's okay, then for my daughter, she's like, well, both parents are saying it's okay, so I'm going to do this, I don't know.
Stephanie H. Murray is a contributing writer at The Atlantic, which published her article, The Gravitational Pull of Supervising Kids All the Time. Stephanie, thank you for making time to talk.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find our podcast wherever you like to get podcasts. You just might need to do a search for KERA Think. You can also listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.